Hello, I'm Amanda Stevens, CEO at IPA Victoria. I joined IPA Victoria in January 2024, and it is my absolute pleasure to host this episode of Public Sector Perspectives, our podcast channel featuring conversations that celebrate excellence across the public purpose sector. By way of personal introduction, I'm a committed member of the public purpose sector with over 20 years service in roles across federal, state and local governments, as well as more than 15 community and not-for-profit board chair roles. I'm thrilled to be CEO at IPA Victoria and have the privilege of representing, empowering and celebrating the interests of all public purpose sector professionals in Victoria. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land in where I sit in South Melbourne, the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the people I pay respect to, their elders past, present and emerging. I recognise their continuing connection to the land and waters of this beautiful place. Okay, so let's get stuck into this episode. This episode celebrates IPA Victoria's most prestigious award, the Victorian Fellowship. The episode will highlight and honour the leadership and achievements of one of the 2023 recipients. IPA Victoria Fellowship is awarded annually to individuals who have provided an outstanding and exemplary contribution to the sector, who have demonstrated inclusive leadership, broad support for the sector, and alignment with IPA Victoria's values of innovation, inclusivity, integrity, connection, and excellence. In December 2023, IPA Victoria recognised 6 Victorian fellows, 1 national fellow, and an IPA Life member. Today, I'm joined by Simon Corden, Essential Services Commissioner at the Essential Services Commission. Simon has worked as an executive for the Commonwealth and Victorian governments across a wide range of policy areas with a strong focus on improving social and economic outcomes through regulation. So, welcome. Welcome, Simon, and thank you for joining me today.
Amanda, great to catch up again.
So, Simon, congratulations on being awarded the IPA Fellowship for Victoria this year in prestigious company. Can you please tell our listeners a little bit about your illustrious career?
Well, illustrious, I don't know about that, but I'll tell you about my meandering career. I started out actually as a cadet photographer with the Age newspaper. After school, and I had 7 years there as a cadet, which is like an apprentice, and made my way up through the ranks there. I went to Nicaragua during the Civil War. I did a project with Tim Kolbach on the Mexican and US border, a wonderful journalist who died recently. So that was my first job. And I'll go back to Mexico later on in my career, but if you see Nicaragua and Mexico, you appreciate the value of a well-run government. The importance of good institutions. So after I finished up at The Age, after, as I said, 7 years, I shifted to economics. I wanted something more exciting. So I graduated in economics and then went to the UK, worked for a small economic consultancy there before I came back and joined the Productivity Commission in Melbourne. Helen Silver was setting that up in the Melbourne office, and I ended up being the executive responsible for the report on government services, the Blue Book. I know that there'll be lots of Victorian public services cringing at the word the Blue Book and the report on government services, but that was a great project to be involved in, particularly because it covered so many diverse areas of public of services that states and territories deliver. So that was a really interesting project, and just to get an understanding of this sort of diversity of what governments deliver. And then I moved to the Victorian government, initially with the Premier's Department, under Terry Moran. Terry Moran used to insult me as a dreaded microeconomist on a regular basis. Terry had a view about us economists, but he put up with me for a while there. And after that, I went off to WorkCover, the Victorian WorkCover Authority, which is a fascinating organisation because it's really important from an economic and a social perspective. You know, the premiums are important in terms of a business perspective, but in terms of protections that its OH&S side and its insurance side operate, so great sort of interaction of the economics and the social policy. After that, I headed off to Treasury, and then I did a stint in Mexico, a couple of months, I think 3 months, with the OECD on a project in their competition authority. Again, that's, yes, an interesting period. Mexico, that stage, the drug wars had started, and so every time you got in a cab, it was more dangerous than getting into a Anyway, that had its moments. And then I had 7 years at KPMG as a director in their public policy practice. That was a great experience with the disciplines of having to bid for work to really demonstrate your public value every time against your competitors. So you really have to demonstrate the value that you provided through every project you put in, and you had to manage it to tight budgets because it's a commercial environment. You needed to deliver on time and under budget. And finally, I'm just about to finish a 5-year term with the Essential Services Commission as a commissioner. And one of the things I reflect on in those roles, I've been really fortunate to have some fantastic women leaders along the way. When I was at the Productivity Commission and also at Treasury and at WorkCover, I worked in separate roles with Helen Silver, who is a fantastic person to work for. I've also, when I was at KPMG, there were three of the partners. So Penny Armitage, who many of you might know, was former Justice Secretary in Victoria, but also Elise Wherry and Karina Bertram, two fantastic women leaders. And now I'm at the ESC and our chair is Kate Simons, who's a fantastic, again, another fantastic woman. So I have worked with some good blokes along the way occasionally, but I've been impressed at the opportunities to work with some fantastic women through the years.
That's certainly a lot more than I knew about you. And I think your LinkedIn page doesn't really do you any justice, Simon. That's certainly from journalism to Mexico and Nicaragua, the Blue Book, Treasury, and having some fantastic leaders, and especially female leaders on the way through. That's a lot to talk about. We probably, I feel like there's 10 people we must know in common, but anyway, we'll have to go and have a beer at some stage later. But let's perhaps delve into your time as a commissioner at the Essential Services Commission. Your current role that you've just said you're finishing up. So in that role, your long-term interests of the Victorian consumers are the thing that you're interested in, price, quality, reliability of essential services of energy, water, and transport. Can you tell us a bit about the goals and priorities of the Commission and your time there?
Yeah, look, it's been a interesting and challenging time to be in an economic regulator, pricing regulator. You know, we've got the challenge of how do we get, you know, deliver fair prices as much as possible for energy and water consumers. We've also got to promote efficiency because, you know, everybody is concerned about getting efficient outcomes. But we've also got to create an environment which supports investment. You know, the energy transition is sort of, you can't open the paper without reading something about it. So there's a need for more investment, both in generation, but transmission, et cetera, and retail. So we need to create an environment for that. And also in the water sector that we regulate, because of the importance of, as there's more extreme weather events, there's a need to invest in the water sector to deal with that as well as its sort of continuing operations. So they're the sort of traditional pricing economic regulator sort of roles, and we've also got that in transport. But in the last few years of the commission, there's been a real focus on, you know, trying to get markets to operate more effectively. The Victorian default offer, which we set, which applies as a sort of default if people don't engage with the market. We've got something called the best offer. So on your bills, every 3 to 4 months, it'll tell you whether your retailer offers you a better price. This is something I go on and on about wherever I can, because all of us know someone who's struggling at the moment of high prices, and they can simply switch within their retailer just to a better plan and make big savings. I've been banging on it at the ESC and managed to get someone to check it out, and they managed to save $359 in the next year. It's almost $400. So even people at the ESC aren't looking at their best offer. So if you know anyone
who... Is this just in particular... Sorry to interrupt, Simon. This is just particularly on your electricity bill or your gas, electricity and water?
Electricity and gas. Water is a fixed price, but every 3 to 4 months, your electricity or gas bill, if you look, open up the bill. Problem is many people direct debit, but you open up the bill, there'll be a little box that says that if there's a better offer, that's just sticking with your current retailer. And usually you can do it online or over the phone, switch to a better deal. So that's something that was introduced in Victoria. They're looking at it nationally. And I think that's a really important way to help people save money, but not everyone's taking, I think only about 50% of people are on their best offer. Some of them could get small savings, some could get big savings. So everyone knows at work that I'm a big advocate of the best offer. So, and the other thing that we've been doing, which has been really exciting to be involved in, is trying to work more on how, as an economic regulator, we can support people experiencing vulnerability. So under the previous chair and CEO, Ron Ben-David and John Hamill, there's a big push on family violence, on making sure that the energy and water businesses were very mindful of mitigating any risks associated with family violence. So someone rings up and says they're changing address, don't provide their address to their partner. There are all sorts of ways in which these businesses can better protect people who are experiencing family violence. And the other project I've been involved in is a project, sort of a strategy on getting to fair, which is looking at the whole array of ways in which, as an economic regulator, we can do more to help people experiencing vulnerability. So that's been exciting to be involved in. And in addition to that, over the last 5 years, the Commission has become much stronger as a compliance and enforcement agency. I know, Amanda, you were involved in the Victorian Building Authority some time ago. You know, the challenge of becoming an effective compliance and enforcement agency, it's not a simple task. And I've been involved in the sort of five-year journey that, as we've become a more mature regulator, getting that balance between helping the businesses that we regulate to comply, but also when there is behaviours that are inappropriate, making sure that there's a tough cop on the beat. So It's been a lot of fun. 5 years, great place to work. I'd encourage any of your listeners to watch out for any positions coming available there.
Fantastic. And it's such practical work. I mean, from the outside, you just possibly wouldn't expect that there's that much practical work that you could do, you know, in the things that you've mentioned there around the best offer and things around family violence and, you know, also the delicious work of being an effective regulator, as we know, very, very difficult, but good work to be involved in. So excellent. I might move now to a bit of a question around integrity. So acting with integrity and upholding ethical standards is obviously something that as public servants we're always interested in. But I guess in the light of Robodebt Royal Commission at a federal level and the UK Post Office scandal, what are your reflections after your sort of career on these kinds of integrity issues, Simon?
Firstly, I'll give a call out to the Westminster Transition podcast. I don't know if you're happy for us to advertise alternative podcasts on your
Absolutely.
Podcast, but it's a fantastic one. And they've covered this off quite well, I think. I mean, one of the challenges, I think, as public servants, often we come from a segment of society we're not necessarily truly representative. You know, there are people with lots of lived experience of challenges within the public service, but a lot of us come from a more privileged. And so both Robodebt and the Post Office scandal in the UK, the people making the key decisions didn't really understand the pressures and priorities and the challenges of the people that they were overseeing. So that was one of the first things that really struck me. You know, and that sort of brings with it a power imbalance. It brings with us the people that are where the government is doing something to them, understanding why don't they complain? Well, often people feel disempowered. They feel really challenged. So really trying to understand that experience of the people. So that's what I think is one of the things that struck me about that. I think in both cases, there was a lack of desire to brief up about bad news. In Robodebt, it was, you know, that there were, well, everyone's heard all the stories about all of the problems with it that didn't necessarily get briefed up all the way up the line. But also in the Post Office scandal, the fact that the IT system wasn't working was something that didn't seem to get briefed up. So I think that is a terrible story. And there does seem to be an issue about, you know, accountability and consequences. There's obviously been very severe consequences for the client. Both in Robodebt and in the Post Office scandal. There'd be two other things. One is tardy remediation. In both cases, it's been known for some time that there was a problem and that something needs to be done to remedy the issue for the people who have been affected. And the final one, I think, is the positive role of the media. So, you know, in the regulatory space, many regulators have been through a pretty tough time as a consequence of Four Corners. Not much fun to go through it or other parts of the media, but it's such a critical role in ensuring, you know, better public services and accountability. And we should be happy, well, happy about that, but we should welcome that. And in the Post Office case, it's blown up recently since a show was shown in the UK TV called Mr. Bates and the Post Office, which looks an extraordinary program and is shortly going to be showing on Australian TV on Channel 7, I'm told. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that because it's amazing the power of that storytelling of television that can help achieve change and bring things up the agenda. It's a bit of a long-winded answer to that one, Amanda.
No, I love that. I think we've got a couple of recommendations for podcasts as well. So you were referring there to the Westminster Tradition, I think it's called, which is some South Australian public servants who go forensically through the robo debt. I think it's 16 episodes. And look, I think I did the first couple and then I did the last one, but amazing. Real forensic, pulling apart of that issue. And now I need to go and watch Mr. Bates in the post office on commercial TV, no less.
Yes.
So, I think your, perhaps your journalism background sort of giving you that perspective, which is really interesting around how integrity and having something like, a good media really holds us all to account. And that sort of not briefing up bad news. And I think that is, really difficult in a lot of situations. But, I think, and I saw it in COVID, it can be really difficult. But I think, good public servants are able to have those relationships to be able to do that. So what about stewardship, Simon? I've got a question here around, stewardship is something that we talk about in the public service, and it's increasingly important, I think, at a federal and state level. How do you think being a steward and, shapes the way you lead?
So I think as stewardship, which is a new sort of language, I don't remember it sort of 15 years ago talking so much about stewardship, but I think it's good language because it's talking about being a steward for public assets and public programs and for institutions. It's really critical as a public sector leader that you're thinking about the long term, about maintaining and nurturing the organisation. And a critical part of that is about building and retaining the capability of your staff. And I think IPA is obviously, that's a long-term focus, has been on it, its various training programs and ways of bringing people together. But that importance of growing the capability. And I think that one of the challenges in the public sector is in some organisations, senior people get judged by their outputs or how they manage upwards. Whereas it's absolutely critical, I think, that you should be judged on the extent to which you're growing the capability of your organisation, the people that work to you. That should be a critical part of your performance assessment. And so wherever I've worked, I've always, when I'm assessing people below me, I go and talk to the people one step below to them to see, look, they talk the talk and they're talking to me, but what are they like at managing the more junior staff? And I've always encouraged anyone who's assessing my performance to talk to the staff I interact with as well as my peers. That's as good a measure of your performance, because for the long-term stewardship of the organisations, we have to continue to nurture and grow the capability of the staff that we work with. So I think stewardship and this increased focus on capability work really well together.
Interesting, Simon. Thank you for that. I think that is really interesting, and I will mercilessly, shamelessly plug IPA and its, courses and ability to work with individual departments and organisations to also tailor things that, courses and things that suit their particular, needs and the capability gaps that they may find. And I think, reflecting on your answer, it's incumbent upon us as leaders to have that in our KPIs and demonstrate that, we're happy to be held accountable for, what our teams think of us, and have that 360 as, it's sort of, you're right, it's one of those things that's so simple but perhaps not done very much.
I think that, just on that, I think one of the things about IPA and other things I was involved in, ANZOG's community of practice work, is bringing people from across different sectors of the different parts of the public sector is such a crucial role, because you learn from your bosses, but you also learn from your peers, and you learn a lot from working from people in other sectors. Whether it's health people learning from people in education, or whether it's people in the federal or state level learning from people in local government, we've all got something to learn. So that sort of creating that sort of learning environment is really important.
Yes, I absolutely agree. And that networking of peer-to-peers is something that we hear a lot, and we facilitate at sort of several different levels within. And come and talk to us if you're interested in that. But we do try, and the fellows, we put the fellows together. We have Senior Leaders Connect, which is almost like a CEO's forum. And we have other ways that we sort of, through communities of practice as well, where we kind of try and bring people who are interested, say, in a subject matter like sustainability, and they can come together from different organisations to really have that discussion. They find that really rich. So, and also, you know, hopefully at our events, people get that opportunity to mingle and have the conversations that you never get to sort of, especially with this virtual work, and we don't get to bump into each other in the lift well and the lobby quite as much, do we?
And last year, I was the chair of the judging panel for the IPA Leadership Awards, and it was fantastic. I hope all of the regulators who listen to this will put in entries for next year. But the one that won the overall awards was that Network of Women of Colour, wasn't it? Was that what it was called? I'm
yes,
trying to remember
yes,
the name.
Yes.
But a fantastic way of getting these peers together to you know, really nurture them and build that sort of network of support.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, well, well done, Simon. You're joining in the mutual plugging of IPA. That's what it's all about, learning. And but in all seriousness, so the next question I've got for you is about, you know, some practical steps for our listeners. So what are three practical steps people managers can take to foster a robust organizational culture? So, you know, people talk about culture and innovation and transparency and accountability, but how do you really do that in practical terms?
I think you really need to be actively encouraging people to be curious and to respect all the disciplines. You know, I'm an economist by training, but I've loved working in environments where there are economists and non-economists, or people who have a different work experience. So, because often the sort of the novel ideas will come from those interactions across different disciplines, so, and being curious, reading widely, etc. So encouraging your staff to be curious and trying to find opportunities for them to learn. You know, so if you see a good webinar that's coming up, you think that might be interesting, sharing those sort of those opportunities. The second, I think, is sort of trying to encourage a default of being open as possible. So if you're interacting with stakeholders, what can we tell them rather than what's the most we can tell them, not what's the minimum we can tell them. You know, if you're dealing with your colleague, you know, so always have that sort of default of being open, I think is really critical. And the third part, accountability, it always seems to me you have to take responsibility for your team's outputs and outcomes. You know, that's if something goes wrong, you need to take accountability, but you need to focus on creating an environment where you delegate with the staff, you give them guidance, you give them boundaries, and but you don't micromanage, and you create an environment where hopefully not too many mistakes, but people learn from each of them. My first experience, going back to my first job at The Age, I came back from a particular story and they were holding the front page for this photo. I think it was of AFL Tribunal results, which was always lead story in the front of The Age. And I took my chemical, went in, took the photos, came back to the office, put them through the chemistry and put them through in the wrong order. So the films were completely wiped and they were holding the front page for this picture, and came out and told the pictorial editor. And he completely calm just said, Okay, son, we'll work around it. And he said, I'm not going to beat you up. If you do make a mistake once, you know, we'll work that through. If you do it twice, then I'm going to come down on you like a ton of bricks. So he had a very sort of a crowd in a culture where, you know, people made mistakes, you're open about it, but you learnt from it. But yeah, don't repeat them.
Wow, that must have been, you must have been a big gulp to go and tell him that. That would have been, yeah, I think you do, you always remember those kind bosses early on that taught you those lessons. Here's our last sort of wrap-up question for you. So as a an IPA fellow, you're part of a distinguished cohort that can impart wisdom and advice to the public purpose sector. So in your experience, what makes an effective public servant?
I think it's quite a curly question in a way, because what makes an effective police officer or teacher or child protection worker or public, you know, it's quite diverse skills and capabilities and mindsets, etc. So I can't sort of talk about the whole of the public service, but in terms of my area, which has been sort of the policy area and the sort of regulators, that's what I can talk to. In general, though, I suppose the first point is this, which we talked about building the capability of your team. Like an effective public servant is very focused on building the capability of their team, and I'm sure that's true across all of these very sectors. So I think that links back to the question of stewardship. That's really critical. As I think I said earlier, in the importance of being curious, particularly in public policy roles, you know, reading widely, talking to people outside your field, spending time talking to stakeholders. It's amazing the insights you can learn from stakeholders who are at the coalface. An effective public servant is always looking for evidence and insights. Like anecdotes and incidents are great for communication. They're great for telling the story, and they're very powerful for that, but as a trigger for action. But you should always be looking for the underlying data, the more evidence, rather than just relying on anecdotes. So next one I'd say is sort of start with the end in mind. I've seen some sort of people work on projects and they're just focused on the next step without thinking through all of the sequence it's going to go to. So I think that's quite important. And finally, stay positive and try and be resilient. You can see, hopefully, that I'm a reasonably positive person, maybe deluded or positive, but one of the two. But I think it is really important because the nature of the public sector is stuff happens and you need to work your way through it, lift yourself up and keep moving. And so I think that's really critical to being an effective public servant.
Thank you, Simon. That's it's just been a delightful conversation. I've really enjoyed it. We're probably taken up more time than we ought to, but I really have enjoyed your responses and your candor. So thank you so much for your insights, and we've learned a lot about you. And we really congratulate you again on your award as a IPA fellow, and look forward to seeing you at some functions soon. So thanks very much for the opportunity. I look forward to catching up soon, Simon. Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you, Amanda. Good to see you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To learn more about IPA's fantastic events, highly regarded professional development courses, awards, and opportunities to network via our communities of practice and other initiatives, please visit our website at vic.ipa.org.au, and I'll spell that out. So it's vic.ipaa.org.au. In this show, we will put our show notes that will have some of the links to the things mentioned in there, which was the Westminster Tradition, Mr. Bates and the Post Office, and also some shameless plugging of our own courses. And please stay in touch with IPA Victoria by following us along on LinkedIn at IPA Victoria. So that's IPAA Victoria. I'm Amanda Stevens. Thanks so much for listening. Bye now.